Good morning. Welcome to our roundtable panel for this Friday, the 16th of December. A delight to have you all with us on a very, very cold Friday morning. But we'll warm you up, I hope, with good conversation and some companionship while we try to figure out what's happening in this world of ours. We have a great panel to do that with. Let me introduce them to you, and then we'll get started and invite you to join us as well. WAMC's Alan Chartok is here. Good morning, Alan.
Good morning. How are you,
Jim? I'm fine. Very nice to have you here. Author and activist Barbara Smith joins us. Barbara, always a delight. Good morning.
Same here.
Thank you. And communications consultant Teresa Bourgeois, who is with us. Good morning, Teresa.
Good morning. So glad to be here.
Thank you very much. And great to have you with us. All right. Let me remind you, the listener, that you can join us by simply by going to panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org, and we would love your letters. We'll be getting to those momentarily in just a little bit after we talk about a couple of things first. Again, it's panel@wamc.org. All right, let's go to some of the topics that are making news, and I'll begin with a story. Actually, it was breaking on NPR this morning on Morning Edition, where President Obama says the United States will respond to Russian cyber attacks that the intelligence community has concluded were part of an effort to influence the 2016 presidential election. In an interview with NPR's Steve Inskeep that they aired on Morning Edition this morning, President Obama said, "I think there is no doubt that when any foreign government tries to impact the integrity of our elections, we need to take action. And we will, at a time and place of our own choosing. Some of it may be explicit and publicized. Some of it may not be." What does that mean, Alan?
Good for him. I mean, you know, he's got a month to do this in. Obviously, at very worst, there's collusion between Putin and Trump. But at very best, but at lesser, it may be that, you know, Trump is just sort of playing along. But when we remember during the campaign that Trump invited hacking from Putin. Now, he'll say it's a joke, but as Freud said, there is no joke. And I don't know that it was. So in any case, he's got a month. By that time, the intelligence people are all going to get replaced after he leaves office. So if he's going to do it, now's the time to do it. And I think it's great.
Excellent. And Teresa, what do you make of this?
Well, I think it's very important, and he's having a press conference this afternoon, and we'll hear more about it. But I thought it was equally interesting that yesterday Senator Lindsey Graham did an interview with Wolf Blitzer, and he said that his goal is to put, quote-unquote, crippling sanctions against Russia on the president's desk, the president-elect's desk, in the early part of next year, that he wants to hold hearings and then move ahead on this. Because he said it's clear that there's been interference in the U.S. elections. And he says if we don't send a strong message to Russia, then we also will look weak with China and Iran and others. And so I think you have a bipartisan consensus here that something needs to be done. And the only one who is not on board yet is the president-elect.
I did want to ask you, Alan, in that statement from the president where he says, we need to take action and we will at a time and place of our own choosing, but if he's going to do it, he really only has a month, doesn't he?
Right. That's the whole point. That's exactly right. He has 1 month to do it in, Joe, and he really needs to do it. Now, I take some issue with what Teresa just said. And only that, Teresa, which is, you say, it shows that it's bipartisan. You know, Lindsey Graham is a critic of the president-elect. I think it's clear by now that that's what's going on. So what I want to see is whether is feckless a good word? You know, Republicans who are just afraid of, pardon me, their shadows, what they're doing about this. So I'm not so sure it's as united as you might imply.
And I will edit myself when I said the only one that's not on board is the president-elect. That's not true at all. I mean that in terms of among the leadership. We've heard from Senator McCain. We've heard from Senator Lindsey Graham and others. And I think that it will be interesting to see what Paul Ryan will do on this. But remember, in terms of sanctions against Russia, During the Republican convention and the Republican platform, the only thing that the Trump people asked to have changed was removing language that called for stronger sanctions against the Russians for their actions in Crimea. So it will be interesting if, in fact, the House and the Senate Republicans do succeed in putting legislation before the president-elect regarding sanctions, what he does with that. But in advance of that, I think it's clear President Obama, before he leaves, wants to do something, and who knows if he hasn't already done something.
Yeah, well, that's the problem when you're dealing in these areas, because you don't really know what people
do. You never know. He may have already taken action. He said he spoke directly with Putin about this when they met
in September.
Yes. In September, right. Yeah. Right.
Barbara?
I guess I want to talk about this in a different way, which is just how incredibly crazy the whole situation is. I think if somebody had told us 2 years ago that we would be talking about the integrity of a U.S. election having been imperiled and undermined by Russia, one of our obvious opponents, one of our most serious opponents on the entire globe, we would say, what? How did that happen? And then if somebody said, and the person who is president-elect doesn't seem to go along with that description of what actually happened as conveyed by the security apparatus of the United States of America, we would say, again, what? It's just really, it's so out there.
Hey, Barbara, how many novels do you think are being written right now?
It's like somebody is writing a novel in the sky, and just the little actors.
You can't
on
make
the
it
stage.
Up.
No, you can't.
Exactly. You can't make this up.
And there's a phrase that I have at the top of my notes that we can't say on the radio, but it starts with bat and it ends with crazy.
Yeah, there is that. Well, let's talk about the president-elect president-elect's response, as we've all sort of been skirting around it. President Obama made his statement and said we need to take action, and we will. President-elect Donald Trump on Thursday again refused to accept Moscow's culpability, asking on Twitter why the administration had waited so long to act if Russia or some other entity had carried out cyber attacks. The president discussed the potential for American retaliation with Steve Inskeep, as we mentioned. And we should also mention that the Kremlin batted away the warning, saying that it is necessary to either stop talking about it or finally produce some evidence. But Donald Trump has been getting pressure from the Congress to acknowledge intelligence agencies' conclusions that Russia was behind the hacking, but aides said that was all but impossible before the Electoral College convenes on Monday to formalize his victory. Mr. Trump has said privately in recent days that he believes there are people in the CIA who are out to get him and are working to delegitimize his presidency. That, according to people briefed on the conversations who described them, on the condition of anonymity.
Well, I have to say, I think he's doing a splendid job delegitimizing his presidency himself. He's doing a very good job at that, because there's so many things. I'm thinking about the editorial in the Times Union yesterday, which yes. I think is quite remarkable. And it's just chapter, line, and verse of all the actions and the attitudes that he has that are absolutely questionable and, to me, appalling. I don't know that people in the CIA have to be out to get him for these issues to arise, because no one is saying that this hacking affected the outcome of the election, or changed the outcome of the election. Nobody says that the only reason he won was because Russia got involved. But as I said, he's good at delegitimizing his own presidency. He's doing a splendid job with that.
Well, make no mistake about it. This is extraordinarily serious stuff. And we all know that. So it's interesting that he says he can't do it before the Electoral College meets. Well, of course. I mean, because if in fact there was a sense among the electors that there may have been some hanky-panky between Trump and the Russians, and may I just point out for the 100,000th time that there was Colonel Putin, remember him, KGB guy who is very familiar with how all of this stuff works. So would anybody put it past Putin to be pulling the strings, and there are reports that say, in fact, he was pulling the strings. This is extraordinarily serious stuff.
Well, as a former U.S. ambassador to Russia said, McCall, I believe is his last name, if I'm pronouncing it correctly, that you can't imagine a scenario in which the Russians would have done this without direct approval by, if not direction, by Putin. Mm-hmm. But I was fascinated with why the Trump folks would say we can't address this until after the Electoral College votes. I can understand why they would think it. But what's the strategy behind saying that? What do you think about that, Alan? I just don't understand that.
Well, I think if there is some substance to this, and there's an impression of substance when they say something like that, it means they're terrified.
Yeah, I mean, it seems that way in the sense of that you don't want to dig up something that where you may find something, right? You don't want
but
people thinking.
Why would they say that out loud? Why would the Trump people make that statement?
I don't know.
I don't understand that. Strategically, I don't understand that.
I don't know, but sometimes, you know, Trump is impulsive. And we know that from the tweets, right?
Sometimes.
Yeah, well, no. There are times I've always thought that, you know, he's sort of knew what he was doing. I don't like the way he does it. I don't know why he does it. Well, I do know why he does it, but he's throwing more red meat to those people who, you know, who are really angry and upset. But in this case, I think there are times that this guy wakes up in the morning and his brain is behind his tweet. In other words, one is running faster than the other.
Well, I want to take there's a very interesting article in the Los Angeles Times this morning, which is an analysis of Donald Trump's Twitter use, and you would think that it is fluff, but it's really a very interesting piece about how he apparently wants to govern and to settle some scores. I want to talk about that. Let's take a quick break. We'll continue when we return right after this.
South Hadley. Since 1963, an independent bookshop offering books and gifts for all ages, author events, first editions club, Odyssey Kids program, and more. OdysseyBKS.com. And the Unitarian Universalist congregations in the Capital Region and beyond, exploring winter holidays from many faith traditions with Christmas Eve and solstice services and more. HudsonMohawkUU.org.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok is here, Teresa Bourgeois, and Barbara Smith, and we welcome your comments as well. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. So I was mentioning this Los Angeles Times article, and yesterday Donald Trump was going on about the Russian interference, and he said that the Obama administration had not raised an alarm about Russian interference in the presidential election until after Hillary Clinton's defeat. In fact, on October 7th, the administration issued an official statement accusing the Russians of being behind the cyber attacks that appear to have harmed Clinton's campaign. The administration's statement said at the time only Russia's most senior officials could have authorized these activities. Nor was the issue a surprise to Trump. He had publicly called on the Russians in July to find and release Clinton's emails. He talked in September about accusations of Russian hacking and commented on them during the fall presidential campaign. Still, he added some equivocation to his false tweet Thursday, quote, "If Russia or some other entity was hacking, why did the White House wait so long to act? Why did they only complain after Hillary lost?" In another message Thursday, Trump accused the media of working so hard to make my move to the White House as it pertains to my business so complex when actually it isn't.
When he had also earlier said that it was so complex that he couldn't have the press conference to talk about divesting because it was too soon, but that's a separate matter.
Well, that
good point.
Right. So here's the question, and I know this may come off. I hope I ask it as a serious question, which is, and I think we're going to be saying this a lot over the next 4 years.
No, kill me now.
Here's the serious question, which is, what do you believe? So if you have the campaign saying, or you have them saying, even him saying at one point, well, it's very, very complex, and then he writes a tweet and says, oh, it isn't complex at all. Which of those are you supposed to believe? Because those comments come within days of each other.
Well, you know, those diagnoses that people had, you know, during the campaign of what's going on with him psychologically and emotionally, that's, you know, his behaviors, to me, are the way he expresses himself and the things he says one day versus another. It's kind of erratic.
I understand that part of it, and I don't like, you know, obviously we don't want to diagnose people.
No.
But I'm curious as to if it also, I mean, Alan, do you think it's a strategy too of just you say something until something sticks?
Yes, that's part of it. But Johnny Carson, the great political philosopher,
yes. yes,
once had something extraordinary to say, which I think of all the time. By the premise, by the gag. So he sets up a lot of premises here which aren't true. And what's interesting is the Times, the Los Angeles Times, the Washington Post have been basically calling him and saying, in an untrue statement.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Nobody raised the Russians before the election. No, they did. But he keeps saying it over and over again. That, by the way, is 101 on propaganda. That's what they did with Obamacare. That's what they do again and again, which is to say an untruth so many times that there are people who truly believe it. And that's what's so sort of sick about the whole thing.
Of course, President Reagan was famous for making things up and saying them over and over again and was labeled the Teflon president. But I don't think to this extent and to this degree of potential harm. One of the things I thought was interesting in that article was the expert who was noting that for any president has to have a trust-based relationship with the country he or she leads. And over time, this can become really troublesome because particularly in times of crisis, you need to know you can believe what your president says. And so this is going to be, you know, it's a short-term problem, but it might be a long-term crisis.
We're going to take a pause there, take a break with the news, and we'll be back and continue our conversation. We have letters and much more. Alan, Teresa, Barbara, I'm Joe. We're all here. Write to us, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. We are talking about the news of the day. We've been talking about so far the mostly the Russian story and also Donald Trump's use of Twitter. One thing I did want to mention that was part of this Los Angeles Times article about the strategy of the tweeting, that in this article they say, quote, it is a strategy that has helped Trump gather a band of enthusiastic supporters large enough to win the presidency, but poses the threat of further alienating those who did not side with him and with whom a more conventional president-elect might want to ingratiate himself during his pre-inaugural period. Alan, that doesn't seem to be on his radar.
Well, no. I'm more interested. I frankly want to defer on this one to you know, to the others, because I found myself being diverted.
Okay. Fair enough. I know you had some thoughts,
Yeah, there was something
Barbara.
I wanted to say before the break, which is that I don't think he's trying to be seen as credible by everyone. He's talking to his base. This victory, endless victory tour that some think will go on for the next 4 years, that he will be out on the hustings, so to speak, for the next 4 years, fanning dissent, fanning false you know, false logic and false facts, if that such a can be such a phrase. I saw him. They were replaying it this morning, and he was talking about having won in a landslide. What's the definition of a landslide?
Yeah, behind 2.7 million votes. Yeah, I mean,
right, and even the electoral landslide, which is not true either.
Yeah, but I'm wondering about one thing there, Barbara, that you may want to react to, and that is, is it possible this guy believes that what he is doing in this sort of corporate takeover, corporate military takeover of America. Let's face it, that's what it is.
It is.
You take a look at the cabinet, that's who they are. So I'm asking you whether or not he believes in his own heart, mind, that this is going to work, that he is going to bring America to great new heights. He's going to make it better again, and that by doing this and taking off all of the restrictions and by not helping others, that basically America will grow because you don't have to worry about despoiling the environment, for example.
I have no illusions that he cares a whit about anything that regular people, that is the 320 million of us, give, you know, minus a few billionaires or whatever. I don't think he cares about what is happening to us or the country at all. I think that this is his biggest deal yet. The fact that he doesn't, you know, and will never apparently disclose his income tax, which would be a way of seeing what his holdings are. The fact that he refuses to talk about his plans for divesting. That's a press conference, right, that he canceled yesterday, or at least, if not divesting, but, you know, getting his assets managed by someone outside of his children. He doesn't care about that. This is a huge, huge opportunity for him and the people he appointed to his cabinet to make out like bandits on the back of the American people. That's what I think.
You know, I have to say that I've been watching C-SPAN, too, I believe, has been running some of the interviews, kind of the exit interviews of presidents at the end of their terms and talking about what they have accomplished their time in office. And I've been, of course, we're starting to see these interviews now with President Obama. He did a very nice one on Trevor Noah on Monday. And then also seeing with George W. Bush, Bill Clinton, George Bush Sr. And those interviews have been fascinating because they are, they listen, even presidents of, certainly George W. Bush had some very rough days in the White House and a lot of criticism from the left, but you listen to him speak and you listen to him talk and being very self-aware of what was right and what was wrong and what went wrong and a self-awareness and an understanding, and at the core of it, serving the people. And it's hard, and maybe it's, I don't know, maybe it is unkind of me to suggest that we should see that at this point, but you never get a sense of that with this particular man, that there is any degree of interest in the people and the country as a whole.
When you say this man, who do you mean?
Donald Trump.
Donald Trump, yes. Okay.
Our president.
He wants people to like him. He wants people to look up to him and worship him. I don't think he really cares. And he can accomplish that through chance, through locker ups and, you know, build the wall. Do you see what I'm saying? It's all around fandom. It seems like it's around fandom and his immensely undernourished ego. That's what it's about. So he likes the fact that so many people like him. He likes the fact that so many people voted for him. He likes the fact that he is president-elect. But as far as like what we have to deal with on a day-to-day basis, I don't think he really cares that much.
It goes back to the statement, and this has certainly been said by many great minds, but of that whole idea of making America great again. But we haven't heard a whole bunch about what makes America great in the first place.
Right. And I think that if you look at the polls and the analysis and the question and answers about those who supported him, they felt that they felt economically insecure, and they felt that he's the one to bring their jobs back. And I hope for the sake of the country that he is, that he can do that. But when you look
at what cost?
But when you look at what he says, and he doesn't have any appearance of the ability to govern, and as Joe says, it's this notion of whose side is he on really, and is in question. And also, his proposals don't add up. And he's surrounding himself with people whose experience doesn't lead one to believe that we'll move in that direction. So it is a worrisome time.
I have we have many letters. Let me get to those, and we'll go to the break. Go into the break reading some letters, and then we'll come back and hit some other topics as well. Andrea writes, since Trump publicly requested an enemy hack our country, thus resulting in a hack, can he be brought up on espionage charges? It seems quite clear that his actions and words can be directly connected to the result. I don't know that we know that, right? That
no,
there's a direct connection.
We can't. Nothing could be done. Yeah, it would be terrible. It would be treasonous. But unless you have the proof, you haven't got anything. And right now, there certainly is no proof that we know of that such a thing exists either between him and the Russians or between any of the people who work for him and the Russians. So the answer is it's an appealing notion to some, but you have to have the proof.
There is a bipartisan group of ethics lawyers who have joined together to create a coalition who will be watching these kinds of issues and examining these kinds of issues. And I say bipartisan, it includes ethics lawyers who served President Bush and President Obama and others.
What's unsettling is that during the campaign, he said repeatedly how much he liked Putin. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yes.
So the thing is, if we had a candidate who... during a time when hacking is discovered from Russia, was not saying how he thinks that Putin is a great guy and he's clearly a better leader than Obama, I don't think that's not airtight court-approved evidence by any means, you know? So, no, there is no proof. But the thing is, he built a perception of like, we're tight. And then he puts people in his cabinet who get awards from... From the Russians, right.
Well, Barbara and Alan both lived through Joe McCarthy. That's our age. And did you, Barbara, you were...
Yes, I was on Earth. I mean, yes. I was pre-K, but...
I was in junior... To give you even a better hint, I was in junior high school.
See, that's... Yeah.
And I recorded Edward R. Murrow's See It Now sitting in front of the television with this lunky tape recorder and then peddled it around to people as he exposed Joe McCarthy. The point of all of this is we don't know what's coming. We don't know if you have a group of ethics lawyers, for example, who get together and say, we're going to disclose what we know about this guy's ethics. Look, we have to be extraordinarily aggressive about protecting civil liberties now. Because if, in fact, you get a president who once said, no, beat him up to the guy who was protesting, we don't know what's coming next. And I tell you, I don't know about anybody else, but I've seen it before, and I think we're going to be seeing it again.
The other piece of information, Alan, that we don't know is what's at the heart of his connection to Putin and to the Russians, and is it a personal economic connection?
Yep.
And that, I think the USA Today has a story, I believe it's in today's paper, about while they tried repeatedly to create new investments in Russia that may or may not have panned out, but a lot of Russian money is invested in his real estate in the U.S. and around the world, and with the oligarchs and such. And also you have the situation with Tillerson, with his connections with Exxon and those two.
Rex Tillerson. Who is the nominee for Secretary of State.
Right.
Which is one of the reasons, you think, right, that we have to be so aggressive about this, because the Russian press has basically been closed down. And, protest in Russia is basically unknown because of the KGB guy. Look, people are ending up murdered. People are ending up in jail, all of that. So, this guy's going to be your friend? I don't know. But I can tell you one thing. An aggressive investigative press in this country is extraordinarily important. But it would be helpful to have one in that country, too, who could be doing some of this work.
We have more letters. Holly writes, it's hard to imagine that Trump didn't know about the Russian involvement in his election, if you want to call it that. Once that can be established, criminal charges of treason can be levied against him. McConnell and the Republican leadership who elected to suppress the information from the American people prior to the election. If Trump is not permitted to ascend to the presidency because of this, that would be a substantial response to the Russian interference.
It is absolutely critical that all electors be required to be briefed on this matter with everything we know prior to their vote. And I think this also means the college must meet later in the week. We should note both things have been called for. Many of the electors have asked for a briefing and to find out what was known and when it was known. Also, there has, I believe, two key congressmen, both Republican and Democrat, who have called for the Electoral College meeting to be delayed. And I think there is safe to say that there has not been any movement on either of those.
I think it's safe to say that on December 19th, the Electoral College will meet and he will be selected. And on January 20th, he will be sworn in as the 45th president of the United States.
Perla writes, if we discuss the possible hacking after the electoral vote, as the Trump team is suggesting, could he be looking at being impeached, going back to business as usual, and having Pence as president? Alan?
No.
All right.
I mean, anybody who knows this guy's ego or who sees it would say, why in the world would he do that? It's possible. I suppose anything's possible. But I don't believe it for a second. I don't believe they chose Pence to be the vice presidential candidate so that he could be the president. On the other hand, what makes it such an appealing sort of scenario, if you think about this, is that they Trump has so many conflicts of interest. I mean, how is he going to really get around all the investments? How is he going to get around the kids, the no blind trust, but letting his kids... obviously, it's a ruse. Run the thing. How's he going to get around Melania being kept in New York while his daughter becomes the de facto, first lady? And what investigations and what journalism is going to be going on around Melania and how she got into this country? There is such a long list of these things that it becomes an appealing thing to say, okay, to the corporate elite in this country who obviously have just won an election. We'll give you your guy. On the other hand, I don't believe it for a second.
And what's unfortunate for the American people is there really are a lot of challenges and opportunities that our country faces right now, whether it's around health care or infrastructure or, all sorts of global issues, which is what we really need to be focused on. And I think instead we're going to be focused on these conflicts of interest. If he, at minimum, does not separate himself from that hotel in Washington, D.C., even at minimum, as a gesture. These conflicts will abound.
We're getting a lot of different information. People are writing to us and saying he doesn't really have $10 billion. In fact, he owes $1 billion. We have no idea about that. The only thing that we know is that what he says. And we don't have any independent collaboration, as in, let's see the tax returns.
Well, we're going to pause and take a break. We will be right back. We have much more to discuss. We have letters, we have topics, and we have our panel here as well. You can write panel@wamc.org. We'll be right back after this.
Support for WAMC comes from the Daily Hampshire Gazette, providing news and information for Hampshire County in print and online, gazettenet.com. The Waldorf School of Saratoga Springs, giving children the education and tools for the challenges of an ever-changing world. WaldorfSaratoga.org. Watercolors by Edith Shutesbury, Massachusetts. Edith Huntsberger, a painter in acrylic and watercolors, specializing in portrait paintings of people and pets from photographs. Edith-Huntsberger.artistwebsites.com. And Sheehy Opticians, Albany, New York, providing eyeglasses, contact lenses, and eye exams since 1953, now accepting toy donations for Toys for Tots through the end of the year, sheehyopticians.com.
Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Teresa Bourgeois, and Barbara Smith making up the panel this morning. Do you want to get to the mean mail?
Okay.
Yes, I wanted to do that, Joe. That's right, because we always love to read the mean mail, and here's one. You people are the most hypocritical people. You think the politicians in office have the ability to do better than successful experts. You are and have been indoctrinated by socialists and are trying to take our country in a different direction, not Trump. Trump is trying to adhere to the republic that the founders wanted. How can you not see that? Sheesh! That's from Mark.
And then if you go up to, Mark has an addendum that says, okay. It says, you can tell me, do you really believe the crap you were spewing daily? Come on, tell me the truth.
Well, by the premise, by the gag, we don't believe it's crap. I could say something really mean, but think, you know, then I get a letter about that. So, no, we don't think that. We believe what we say, and that's the way it is.
All right. We also got this one from Molly. It says, is it possible that Mr. Trump is waiting until after the Electoral College votes in order to see which way the wind is blowing? If a member of the college changes their vote, he can claim interference. If nothing changes, he can claim that the allegations of interference are false.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, there's no winning in a situation like that.
Not a bad theory. Well,
right? What he's been saying is that people knew and it didn't matter, right? They knew he had this business all around the world and it didn't matter.
We got this from Bunny, who writes, when are we going to see this as the act of war against this country that it is? And then what do we do about it? Clearly, Trump's victory was guaranteed by this action. Plus, all of Trump's cronies are going to benefit financially by business dealings in Russia. Is it possible that the Electoral College will not vote Trump in? Could we be that lucky? This is all frightening. That from Bunny. Catherine says, if Trump did indeed ask Russia to hack into Clinton's emails, that is, to ask another and hostile government to interfere in the U.S. election, isn't that treason? And couldn't he be prosecuted for that? I think that gets back to what we were talking earlier about proof, right?
For the 100th time, you have to prove it. If you prove it, remember that the downfall of Richard Nixon were the tapes. Remember that? If there were no tapes, there'd be no Richard Nixon potential impeachment, which is why he resigned. You got to have proof.
Glenn from Greenville writes, I hope you'll take some time this morning to talk about David Friedman, Trump's nominee for ambassador to Israel. He is a bankruptcy lawyer with no diplomatic experience who represented Trump in his Atlantic City casino bankruptcy. He opposes the two-state solution and favors annexation of the West Bank and the relocation of the U.S. Embassy to Jerusalem. It ensures an escalated conflict in the region. We were looking to talk about this. The president named David Friedman yesterday, and he is outspoken and views stand in stark contrast, as according to the New York Times, to decades of American policy toward Israel. And he did not wait long on Thursday to signal his intention to upend the American approach. In a statement from the Trump transition team announcing his nomination, he said he looked forward to doing the job from the U.S. Embassy in Israel's eternal capital, Jerusalem.
Good grief.
Well, look, he is not alone in feeling that. There's a whole group of people in America who think that Israel is our staunchest friend, that the Arab community will never be there for America, that Israel is. I'm sure you all saw the Netanyahu interview on 60 Minutes. Was it last week, Joe? I think
yes.
So.
Yes,
Sunday night. And if you didn't, you should.
Which was extraordinary. That is a way of thinking, and it's apparently quite popular in the United States. And yet, the other side of this is pretty frightening, which is if you have a population which really believes that this will never work out, somebody's going to strap a bomb to their back and walk across the border or go through a tunnel or throw some more rockets at Israel, which may in fact leave them in worse position than they are now. And that is the great dilemma. Barbara, you said, but go ahead.
I said good grief.
Yeah.
I think, you know, for decades, there's been efforts by so many just people on the ground. There are people in Israel who wish there to be a solution to the situation that they're living on. And there's a peace movement in Israel. There are people who favor some version, I think, of a two-state solution who are Israeli. So it's not just crazy left-wing Jewish people in this country who he feels the need to, insult and to disagree with.
And it's quite an insult. It's quite
incredibly insulting.
Yeah, he calls them basically collaborators.
Exactly.
And as one who fits into that category, because I believe in a two-state solution, I believe it's the only way to go. I think Rabin was a hero, the greatest general probably that Israel has ever known, and assassinated Sadat, assassinated for doing it. We've interviewed a lot of the major people on the air, both from the Israeli government and from J Street, which is, of course, the peace movement in Israel and the people from a different perspective, including Diane's daughter, who came to the WMC studios to talk about all of this. So it is really, people who call me up and they say you're not a good Jew, and because you don't believe that it should be one-sided, and my response has always been, and I hate to say this, I'm better than you are, because I want to see the Jewish state survive, and I want to see these folks do well, and I know this isn't the way to do it.
Teresa.
Candidate Trump said he was going to shake things up, and the people who voted for him because they, said they wanted him to shake things up. But I'm not sure that this is what they were hoping for. And I think about this decision in combination with what he said about China, in combination with supporting Putin and their, by association, what's going on in Syria. And there is a lot of potential for tremendous destabilization around the world that we should all be very concerned about.
Yes, but I think it's exactly what he was going to do. I think his level of analysis is, if you went out and asked the American people in a poll, how many of you side naturally with Israel and how many of you side naturally with the Arabs? And the answer is always going to be with Israel. The reason for that is that the Arabs have, since King Richard led the Crusades, there has always been this anti-Arab sentiment in this country, and he knows what he's doing.
All right, let's take a break. We'll come back and talk more about all of this. And we'll get to more letters and we'll get to more topics and all that good stuff. Alan Chartok, Teresa Bourgeois, and Barbara Smith, we welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be back after a short news break. Good morning and welcome back to the roundtable and to the panel discussion this morning. We have a lot of letters, and I do want to get to those. I do want to get to two other topics, though, and get to things because, as we noted during the break, actually, there are two issues that are related to one another somewhat, if not just by geography, by other issues as well. First of all, we will talk about Dylan Roof, who was found guilty in the Charleston church massacre. This is in South Carolina. Dylan Roof, a self-radicalized young white supremacist who killed 9 black parishioners last year when he opened fire during a long-planned assault on the Emmanuel African Methodist Episcopal Church, was found guilty by a federal jury on Thursday. 22 years old, he stood, his hands at his side and his face emotionless as a clerk read the verdict aloud in federal district court, where he had been charged with 33 counts, including hate crimes, resulting in death. Barbara.
I really don't have anything to say about this. I said during the break that I wished to talk about it, but I guess what I want to convey is how absolutely demoralizing, and that's such an understated word, it is to continually be faced with the level of anti-black racism that we have in this nation. I'm trying to find the quote, and I won't be able to from this story, but the word unfathomable is used in the New York Times story about this crime. And my question is, what in the world is unfathomable about it? We live in a nation that has never, as I've said before on this show, has never seriously addressed the reality of the system of white supremacy. They don't acknowledge that white supremacy actually is functioning here and drives so many of our day-to-day expected, not just interactions, but institutions and, you know, whether you can get a loan or, you know, or if you get a worse deal on a mortgage loan than the person who is less qualified than you because of race, et cetera, et cetera. We never acknowledge that that's what's going on, nor do we have any collective decision. We got to end this. We got to get rid of this. As long as you have white supremacy running kind of simultaneous and parallel with institutions that are recognized, you're going to have these kinds of events.
Please don't take this for sympathy in any way, but we also have to look at the issue of what happens in a very young mind at 22 years old, of what brings that, even if these, even, I mean, I understand that that is, you know, you're an adult at that point, but that's still a very, very young man who obviously had issues. And so you look at what happens in a very short period of time of to garner that much hate and what goes on.
What struck me about this is that it's a reminder of the power of words. And the power of words, the written word posted online that influenced a deeply troubled mind already. And that, you know, words of hate posted on the internet that he, you know, enveloped himself with and drove him to do this reportedly. The power of words of forgiveness when the family really set the tone right after. These were not, you know, famous people, but they became very powerful in setting a direction of how we all would respond right after. And then the power of words of healing when President Obama went to the church and gave what I think was one of his most amazing speeches that ended with joining everyone in singing Amazing Grace. And I think that it just is a reminder that of how much influence individuals can have on other people and affect the whole country in a positive or a really just horrendous way, and that we need to keep that in mind.
Alan?
I want to go back to Barbara and ask her a question, because I have tremendous faith that she knows what she's talking about here, and she's right about everything she said. But Barbara, how do we do it? In other words, what do we do to end this economic system, which, of course, is basic to racism in this country, because one begets the other, and we know it. How do we change it, especially with this coming presidency?
Well, see, that's the issue. I'm remembering back to the Clinton administration when he announced a nationwide focus upon the issue of race. I remember very clearly because I had some skepticism even at that point, but there was a beginning of a dialogue mandated coming down from the White House that we're going to look at race and racism in this country. I don't know if anybody else remembers that. It was in the mid-1990s. Right after that, the Monica Lewinsky situation became visible. And that dialogue about race never, ever came to full fruition. So that's an example of what someone in leadership, the highest level of leadership, could do. Now, Obama apparently did not feel that he could do that, and there's a lot of criticism of him, particularly and specifically from African Americans, that he did not do nearly as much as he could as the first black president to help the black community, including dealing with the reality of ongoing racism and racial discrimination. I'm not saying they did nothing. It's just that I think he took a more kind of global view of, like, a rising tide raises all boats. His situation as the first black president, there's a great article by Ta-Nehisi Coates in The Atlantic, which is titled My President Was Black, and it talks about what it was like for people who are of African American heritage, what it was like to have a black president, and also what it's like to be contemplating the future. But there needs to be, first of all, acknowledgement. You know, just like in those stages of grief, you have to acknowledge what is going on. And the thing is, if the term white supremacy is virtually never used, and we talk instead about prejudice, racism, bigotry, whatever it is that we feel more comfortable with, we can't even get to it. The the AP American History exam, there was a big furor over that exam in Texas because it raised the concept of white supremacy. So it's a real thing, but you can't talk about it on an AP in an AP history course because that some feathers might get ruffled.
And like about Breitbart News, we use the word alt-right rather than white supremacy.
As opposed to Ku Klux Klan.
Right, right.
Yes, I mean, I've been saying this week, we have the Ku Klux Klan in the White House because we have Steve Bannon and all who feel comfortable with him in the White House. And, alt-right equals Ku Klux Klan. It's just another term for the same thing.
Okay, but still, and with all due respect, Barbara, the question I have is what do we do now to combat this?
Are you talking about regular people on the ground?
I am. People who are concerned. People who think you're right.
First of all, I think it's so important for people to educate themselves about what the parameters of the problem actually, what the parameters are. As I've mentioned, and as many people know, I've devoted my life to teaching African American studies, specifically African American literature. But of course, that encompasses history for decades. That's why I went to graduate school, so I could teach African American literature. Could you major in it? Could you take courses in it? No, not in the early 1970s when I was in graduate school. As I said, I've devoted my life to that, and I'm still learning new things this many years later. So first of all, I would say immerse yourself in facts about the history, and then find people, like-minded people, like people here in the Capital District and other places nearby who are involved in organizations like SURGE, showing up for racial justice. We always have had anti-racist movements in this nation, including, of course, and starting with the abolitionist movement. There's always something that we can do.
I want to ask you guys, if I can, a question that may be seen as distractive, but I want to ask it anyway. The jury is now going to have a choice, I think it's the jury, of life in prison or executing this guy. I wonder where that fits into the paradigm that you've been describing right now. We had people talking about forgiveness in the church, people who were there. So what do we do now? What does that jury do now? What should it do?
Barbara, did you want to start?
I don't believe in the death penalty.
I agree.
I'll never forget watching the day that Timothy McVeigh was executed, right, and just having those horrible feeling about the fact that there was an appointed time for this individual to be killed. Even in that case, I felt, no, this is not the right way to go. For him, I want this very young person, I want him to live out his decades day after day, minute after minute, day after day, year after year, contemplating. He may come to a point sometime in his 40s or 50s when he begins to understand, oh my goodness, that was wrong. Do you see what I'm saying?
So
that I'm looking for his redemption. That's not what I'm saying at all.
But there's a social cost for the death penalty.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So he's 50 years old, and he says, I really was stupid. I was 22 years old. I should not have done that. It was terrible. There isn't a day I don't think about it. I'd like parole now.
I think, sentencing can be done without parole. I mean, we have a very broken parole system in New York State, and there are people who never get out, They're definitely, and I'm not in any way approving of, or advocating for people not to have the possibility of showing that they have indeed found another way of being in the world that we would consider to be a humane way to be in the world. I'm absolutely for parole reform, but I don't know, that's not up to me actually to decide because I don't know.
No, but I'm asking
points.
You. But I don't, see, that's why the panel is so interesting because you're here and so am I, and I'm asking you. I mean, I got a certain amount of solace, I think, out of the fact that basically a Southern jury found this guy guilty. Because we've seen examples of where they don't, where they won't.
Like in the Walter Scott case.
Yeah, right, where they don't and they won't. But here they did. Now, what do you think that jury is going to say right now? Does the jury decide the death penalty? And does anybody know?
I think they make a recommendation, but they'll also hear from the families. And then ultimately, I think the judge decides on sentencing. Is that correct?
I believe so.
And but there's also then a second case because there's a state case. And it's interesting to me that they offered for him to plead guilty with life without parole, and they decided to take it to court to actually have the case. But
probably to just go through the process.
Right. Uh-huh. Right. And I think it'll be interesting to see what the families say in this.
So regard. What do you guys think of the fact that they found him guilty? I mean, is that a distraction? Is that, what does that mean? Does it mean that, okay, we're going to prove we're not racist here. We elected a black president. We found a heinous killer guilty. But it doesn't get to Barbara's main point about what the economic social system is in the United States.
Well, I think one of the questions, as you asked, is what can people do and what are the things that come out of this horrific thing? And one of the things that I thought was interesting, a story about what's happening in Charleston in that church and the neighboring church, which is a white church, and they were right a block or two away from each other and they never had any interaction. And now they do. They, the two pastors got together and they brought the parishioners together and they're having conversations, and out of those conversations are coming connections and activities. And I think that that's a lesson for people all over the country, that we need to have conversations with people of different views and different cultural backgrounds and such, and out of that hopefully can come change in a positive way. I think this also it also raises serious issues about mental health and guns, as this is also the week of Sandy Hook, and intertwined in all of this are serious issues of mental health and issues of guns and the toxic mix.
And that, I just want to get back to that, because that was one of the things we raised as we began to discuss this, which is how did he get these views as such a young person? Can we give him a pass on some level because he was so young and perhaps impressionable? To me, that's like asking, like, how did so many people get smallpox or diphtheria or tuberculosis? It's in the atmosphere. It's in the environment. Right. Some people live through those incredible epidemics without antibiotics, before antibiotics were available. Some of them survived and many died, but all were susceptible and potentially at risk. Right. And that's exactly how white supremacy affects us in this country.
And we have to push it back against that. And then there's Breitbart.
I want to take we do have a lot of letters, and I want to end with those, but I do want to get to the other story that we mentioned, and that is the story out of North Carolina. And you may remember, probably do, of course, that there was a runoff, or not a runoff, but
a contested
election in North Carolina, and the Democrat prevailed, Ray Cooper, and now the Governor-elect Roy Cooper of North Carolina is criticizing state Republicans for calling a special session of the General Assembly, which would introduce measures that would strip his powers. And he now is, I believe, threatening to sue. So I'm curious as to, this is another one of those stories where you can't even believe that A, that this is happening, and B, that is legal, but
now let's look at this very quickly.
Yes,
we see that the gerrymander, which is one of the worst things that this country has been used effectively that way again and again and again to rig, in the words of the president-elect, to rig the system. Now along, I take this one by the way very personally, and someday I'll be able to, if anybody wants to, tell you why. But after you win, they take your power away. And I don't know whether the courageous governor will win, governor-to-be will win or not, but it is truly disgusting, and it gives us a perspective on the way the system works, which is if you lose, there's always a way to make it to win. And you can have a constitutional change which strips this guy of his power. It is infuriating.
Teresa, did you want to?
Well, the thing that struck me is one of their main focuses of the Republicans is to control the boards of election, to control the you know,
sure,
to try to reduce the number of people who are voting. And I think that if you are confident in your ideas, then you should be focused on getting as many people as possible to vote. And so that raises some serious questions. Well, but this is a same state in which the House passed a bill enhancing the power of the state. The federal court threw out a law that they'd passed earlier this year, finding it was with almost surgical precision designed to diminish the influence of African-American yes. voters. In August, federal appeals court found that the district maps drawn by the Republicans in their General Assembly in 2012 included more than two dozen districts that were racially gerrymandered, and the court ordered lawmakers to redraw the maps next year. So they have the Republicans have a track record of trying to block people from voting. And what they're most focused now with this new Democrat governor coming in is to hold on to the power to continue to put in place efforts to block people from voting. That is not democracy.
But wait. But the boards of elections, their point is, and on paper it sounds good, that the boards of election should be bipartisan, right? That's what they're saying.
And that wasn't their view until
exactly
until this week.
Precisely.
Last week.
That's exactly, you stole the words right off of my tongue.
I'm so sorry.
That's exactly the point. Where were they during this time when the Republicans had the majority in all these boards of elections?
Sued by the federal government.
Yeah. Okay.
I just want to mention, when people think about the situation in North Carolina, that at least there is probably the most dynamic statewide civil rights movement in the country in North Carolina because of Reverend William Barber and the Moral Mondays movement. And I saw him speaking earlier this week. They are in the fight for their lives, but at least there is a well-calibrated and well-organized effort in that regard already in existence.
An inspirational leader for sure.
Yes, he's a wonderful person.
And then this brings you back also to the Supreme Court, which we haven't heard yet who Donald Trump's Supreme Court pick is going to be, because a lot of this will end up in the courts. And remember that the Voting Rights Act was weakened in the last few years. And there's no sign now with the Trump presidency that it will be strengthened anytime soon. But there is a public opposition to this in North Carolina. The public is outraged they came, and whether or not they'll have any impact, but we'll see.
We are out of time. I want to thank the panel. I want to thank everyone for writing, and we will be back on Monday with another discussion. Alan, have a great weekend. Thank you very much.
And thank you.
Teresa, thank you for filling in over the past several days while Rosemary will be back on Monday. But we look forward to seeing you hopefully before the holiday.
Thank you for having me.
And Barbara, we will see you before the holiday,
Friday.
But we wish you a very happy holiday.
Thank you.
We will talk to you very, very soon. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.